This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Viglund. Tonight on After Paradise, it's been 32 days since the campfire started. Some of the first FEMA trailers have arrived for disaster victims who need semi-permanent housing. We'll get a tour of one of them near Corning. We also go along with workers from the Environmental Protection Agency as they clean up toxic waste from homes that were leveled in the fire. And we'll hear from an official in Sonoma County, where the Tubbs Fire last year prompted serious questions about the emergency alert system. Questions that are now also being asked in Butte County. We want to hear your comments and questions. Leave a message for us at 433-4887 or on our website, mynspr.org. For Monday, December 10th, 2018, this is After Paradise. One of the biggest questions facing Butte County right now is the lack of space to house fire victims who lost their homes and just about everything else more than a month ago. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has been under pressure to quickly provide trailers, but the process to find places to put them has been slow and painstaking. Today, some good news for people who are hoping for a semi-permanent roof over their heads. I'm joined by NSPR's Mark Albert. Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
So you have now been up to see some of the very first trailers of this post-crisis recovery period. What did you see?
That's right, Tess. I was up in Corning at an RV park that's connected to the Rolling Hills Casino, where I met several FEMA officials. They said they had some big news, an agreement with the Paskanta Band of Nomlaki Indians, where the first few FEMA trailers are located and the first few residents will be moving in this afternoon. They said that they had four or five already to be occupied, and they were just coordinating with those families to see when they could get them there, when it would be convenient for them. They plan to have a dozen evacuee families living at that RV park by the weekend.
All right. And I understand you got a tour. So can you give us a sense of what these homes are like?
Absolutely. These are brand new trailers. They're purchased from local RV dealers, and officials said they didn't really need to do much, mainly because the trailers already comply with various state regulations and all the infrastructure at the RV parks already in place. I spoke with Vern Jenkins. He's a manufactured housing unit lead for FEMA. Jenkins helps install trailers. And aside from sturdy wooden staircases with banisters, he said it was all pretty simple.
The RV park here has the correct size water, sewer, and pipe and electrical that we need. So it's just a pull up, plug everything in. I do the inspections on it, and it's good to put people in it.
Well, what about inside?
Well, I received a quick tour of a couple of trailers, and, you know, I have to say that trailers have come a long way. While not exactly luxurious, they're far from hovels. The appliances all have some stainless steel accents. There's nice wood-looking floor, and there's a good-sized TV and a shower that's pretty roomy compared to what you might imagine. Jenkins showed off one of them to me, noting all the places where a bed could appear.
So this drops down and it engages on here. The cushions flop down, come across, so that makes into a bed. So it depends on the size of your family, you know. Usually the parents sleep in there and the two kids sleep in there. The cousin comes over and crashes for the night. This folds out into a bed. The other cousin shows up. If he's short, he can sleep there.
Now, this is only the first of many sites, and aside from privately owned RV parks around the region where FEMA will be placing trailers, FEMA is also preparing to build entire villages of manufactured homes around the region. And really, this is just the beginning of this whole process. Ryan Burris, senior program advisor for the Housing Operations Unit, basically the head housing official for FEMA in California, put it this way.
We have several sites that we're looking at. This is not the only ones. Each site's going to either hold a recreational vehicle or a manufactured housing unit. We looked over, we have over 200 identified sites. We're going through the process right now of leasing those sites from the landowner. And as soon as that is done, we'll start delivering those units.
Officials say they expect to make an announcement in coming days with plans, locations, and timelines. They said the pace of rehousing people into interim housing will increase over the next several weeks. And that interim housing, they imagine people will be in there for perhaps about 18 months.
All right. NSPR's Mark Albert. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Tess.
Residents and survivors of the campfire are now being allowed to visit their properties, zone by zone, throughout Paradise, Magalia, and Concow. What they'll see is vast devastation that is shocking to the conscience. You cannot fathom, until you've been up there, the scale of the destruction that goes on for miles and miles and miles. But the fire zone is no longer a ghost town. PG&E trucks choke the landscape, replacing electrical poles and rewiring electrical lines. Chainsaws puncture the forest quiet, felling trees that are slouching toward death if they're not already there. And over the last few days, you'd be forgiven for wondering if a pandemic had arrived in the fire's wake as white hazmat-suited workers scoured burned-out properties. There's no pandemic, but there is toxic waste that must be removed before the rest of the debris is hauled off to landfills and recycling stations. We met up on Sunday with an EPA team inspecting a property on Lower Honey Run Road. Contractors in full respirators and protective eye masks unfurled thick plastic bags, then started a methodical search of the ash, working from the outer property line, then in toward the center of the properties. As they searched, they used handheld devices meant to detect excess radiation and other toxic substances. Jeremy Johnstone, on-site coordinator for the EPA, gave a rundown of what the team had found on this particular property.
Yeah, they took several car batteries out. They deheaded, took the valves off some empty propane bottles just to prevent them from being reused. They had a gallon of paint thinner, and then they took a rope gasket off of a wood stove that often has asbestos-containing material in it.
I noted to Steve Kalinog, incident commander for the EPA, that one of the strange elements of visiting properties like this is that there seems to be no rhyme or reason to what burns and what doesn't.
Look over across the driveway here, and the basketball hoop is still standing, and the tether ball is still there, and the house and car and everything else are gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Traditionally, house fires burn at about 1,200 degrees or so, and then wildland fires like this start approaching 2,000 degrees, and at about 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit, aluminum starts melting. So we can, even just looking on the ground when we see pools of aluminum, can tell that the fire was burning very hot in certain locations, whereas other parts were, like in this case where the basketball hoop remains intact, it was not nearly as hot in that particular location. So.
We watched as the hazmat-suited workers continued pushing through the debris and packaging it in those plastic bags. Right now, the EPA has about 200 personnel working the campfire. Once teams from Southern California finish up this task on the Woolsey Fire, the number here will rise to about 400. I asked Kalinog to explain this part of the recovery process.
Well, this is the beginning of phase one of the larger debris removal process in the aftermath of the fires here. We are EPA and the California Department of Toxic Substances Control and Butte County Environmental Health are being tasked by FEMA and Cal OES to remove household hazardous waste from damaged and destroyed properties. And this is being done in advance of the second phase, which is the larger debris removal that's going to be done by Cal Recycle. And the objective of this is to remove any traditional household hazardous waste and other hazardous materials that immediately present a risk to human health and the environment, and also in advance and to protect the workers coming in to do phase two.
Can you give us a sense of what you're looking for here in this first phase? You said household chemicals. I assume that's everything from paint to batteries.
Yeah, there's a variety of different things that we would expect to see. A lot of different kinds of household cleaners, paint, solvents, pesticides, fertilizers. You know, a lot of folks have different hobbies that have an associated materials that they use in the process of doing their hobbies that would also be considered hazardous, household hazardous waste or hazardous waste in general.
I assume that you have been to similar sites before, but can you give us a sense of how this is different, if, assuming that it is?
It's daunting. All my colleagues and myself were all involved with the North Bay fires last year. This is at least twice to three times as large as what we dealt with last year in four counties. And here it's largely contained within one community and one county. The terrain is different. The weather is different here. Logistics, getting up into the hills and to the various neighborhoods here is going to present a tremendous challenge. This community was built in a forest. There's a lot of damaged trees here, and that's going to always present risks for our crews out here.
Can you describe what you are actually looking for? What does hazardous material look like to the eyes of your workers?
Paint containers, solvent containers, compressed gas cylinders, they stand out. We're able to see them, identify them readily. There's some things that we, through some probing, we are able to determine to be hazardous waste. Our teams, in the course of doing this initial assessment, as you'll see in this next property, we'll also go through with some monitoring equipment to assess if there are volatile organics or radiation sources or other contaminants that we wouldn't otherwise be able to see immediately with our naked eye that handheld equipment may be able to pick up. The teams will look and try to determine what needs to be removed. We do the best we can, but there are the cases that will have to come back when a follow-up agency may determine there was more hazardous waste there, and we'll come back and get it as well.
Where is all this waste going?
We will segregate the various waste streams. So the like products go with the like products. Like paints will all be consolidated into bulk loads. We have a staging area down in Chico where these materials are transported in containers to ensure that they're not going to be released as we transport them. And then we will ship them off for the appropriate treatment or disposal. And we do this in order to be efficient and effective of getting waste out of here as quickly as possible.
That's Steve Kalinog of the EPA. One of the challenges he mentioned to us was that so many different aspects of the cleanup are happening at the same time, so they have to stay out of each other's way, from PG&E and power lines to the tree cutters to EPA coming through before the garbage trucks and eventually road repair and construction crews coming in to rebuild homes. It's a logistical puzzle among the federal, state, and local governments, utilities, and private contractors. Kalinog said the EPA is aiming to be done with its search of some 18,000 properties by June of next year. Snow and flooding and mudslides over winter could complicate that timeline. If you are a property owner, the EPA will have already been there before you're allowed in. But in order to get the next step of the process, the garbage and recycling trucks picking up all the other debris, you need to sign permission forms. And you can find more information on that process at buttecountyrecovers.org. You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. We'll have more just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Viglund. The campfire left at least 85 people dead. That's despite an emergency alert system and an evacuation plan that had been tested. Residents from throughout the burn zone have complained that they got no word at all that the fire was raging toward their towns and homes. Now officials say it's time to review what happened and try to figure out how to make alert systems work better next time. Because they know there will be a next time. Jeremy Siegel of our partner station KQED reports.
The campfire ignited around 6:30 in the morning. About an hour later, it was making its way toward the town of Paradise. For many residents of the area, that came as a surprise.
There was no evacuation notice. There was nothing on the news. We had the news on. We just knew it was time to go.
Christina Hickson could see the flames.
From where I live, it came right over us. So it was coming that way. And then the lights went out, you know? So we knew it was time to go.
Caroline Bolin is from the neighboring town of Megalia. She says she didn't receive an evacuation alert either.
I never got any text or any information about there actually be a fire or where the fire was. The only reason why I knew is because the sun was blood red and so was the sky.
This fire was outrunning us.
Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey.
In terms of our ability to notify people, get evacuations done, before we even really understood we were in a race.
Honey says his agency has never seen a fire of this speed or magnitude before, and that made the emergency response difficult.
There are plans in place to conduct evacuations, generally staged evacuations based on zones that people live in. We utilize an emergency mass notification system.
The county used something called Code Red for emergency alerts. It's an opt-in system, meaning you only receive evacuation alerts on your cell phone if you've signed up for the service. Some people were notified, but others in evacuation zones were not. So when it became apparent that it was time to flee, many left at the same time. Sandra Peltola of Megalia says she was caught in gridlock traffic.
Yeah. People acting crazy, you know, driving erratically and putting other people in danger. It got crazy. It really did.
There is an alert system already in use in many California counties where notifications can be sent to everyone. It's called WEA, or a wireless emergency alert, and it's an Amber Alert style message sent to all cell phones. Kelly Houston is the Deputy Director of Crisis Communications for the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services.
We now have direct access to the public through these technologies. It's really trying to figure out how do we do it in the most effective way without missing large populations who need to get an emergency alert.
Missing large populations, for instance, if a cell tower goes down or there's no service. In the aftermath of the campfire, Butte County Sheriff Honey acknowledges they'll be looking to improve on their emergency alert procedures. But he says there's no system that's perfect.
I don't want people to have the false sense of security or false belief that there is a perfect solution to every situation and that you can guarantee with 100% certainty that one particular system is going to work every time.
Especially in a fire of that magnitude and for communities like Paradise with limited escape routes. Honey says that there will be a lot of lessons to learn from the blaze, but right now, local leaders are dealing with immediate issues, like finding work and homes for thousands of campfire refugees. Figuring out how to do it better in the next fire may have to wait until the community is fully moving into recovery. I'm Jeremy Siegel in Chico.
Jeremy mentioned the two emergency alert systems currently in use, Code Red and WEA, the Wireless Emergency Alert. The big question is how effective they are at getting notice to people. And that's a question that officials in Sonoma County are looking into. The Tubbs Fire roared through the city of Santa Rosa in October 2017. It was, at that time, the most deadly and destructive wildfire in California's history. 22 people died. This fall, officials conducted a large-scale test of all the alert technologies the county uses. The results were mixed at best. NSPR's Sarah Bohannon talked with Christopher Godley, interim emergency services manager for Sonoma County, who's heading up the research. She first asked him what the county found after running its Code Red test.
We attempted to reach 290,000 phone numbers for a population of 500,000 people, and we were successful about 51% of the time. The major reason the rate is so low is because we found that the database provided by the phone companies is significantly out of date, and we're going to have to do a lot of work on a regular and ongoing basis to, if you would, clean that database to make sure that only good information is contained in order to make our messaging and our targeting more effective. I'd also add on September 12th, we conducted a test of both the WEA system and the emergency alert system. For WEA, we targeted five distinct small geographic areas within Sonoma County that represent the range of hazards and populations that we see in the county. For example, rural or an area that's urban, one that has a significant Spanish-speaking population. And we were looking to determine how effective is WEA in reaching those populations, how good are we at keeping, if you would, the warnings limited to the targeted area, and how quickly can, in fact, we deliver these messages. And we've had a a variety of results from that, but I should also mention the emergency alert system test on that same day also showed that we had some challenges in getting all of our radio stations and cable providers to participate in delivering that test message.
Is it true that for some people, if they were on their phones at the time the alert was sent, that they wouldn't get the message?
That is one of the, if you would, technical issues we're trying to determine if, in fact, if it's the mobile device that's causing those discrepancies and how the WEA message is conveyed and received by a consumer, or is it the broadcaster? Is it the way the messages are being coded for delivery? That's part of the feedback, if you would, that we've provided to the FCC so that they can investigate better and make sure that the technical capabilities of WEA really live up to the expectations that the community has and even all of us as citizens have across the country.
How do you even look into that? How do you even begin to start to figure out what's what and why an alert didn't get sent and why one did?
Well, so that's really part of the exercise that we really focused on was attempting to capture feedback, not just can we in fact activate these systems and deliver messages. We wanted to see in a real way how were these messages being received in the community. So we conducted some feedback sampling efforts. The first was we put trusted listeners, if you would, into each of these targeted areas for WEA. These are individuals that knew when the test was coming, we knew the type of device that they had, and they were able to share with us their experience. So, for example, I'm a Verizon subscriber, and I had my phone turned on, but the volume off, and here's what happened. Or maybe I'm AT&T, and I was on the phone at the time, and this is what my experience was. We also asked the community to give us immediate feedback. So when we delivered the warning message, we did so with an embedded web link that people could click on and give us feedback to about 8 questions about how did this message come across to you? Was it legible? Was it in the proper language? And then did your phone, for example, turn itself on and produce an audible tone even if it had been set to silent? That feature is one of the highlights what the FCC believes to be the case across the country in using WEA. And clearly, we've got documented evidence now that that does not always perform as advertised.
You said earlier that you were surprised when you were going to run the test that more people hadn't done this and that your test was one of the largest on the West Coast. How often are these systems tested? I mean, is there a requirement to test them after these events like this, these big fires or anything?
Well, there's certainly no requirement. But while we conduct tests of these systems, many of your listeners may be familiar with the emergency alert system test that's conducted on radio stations and occasionally TV. Those are relatively routine. They're conducted monthly, and they're using what they call a test code. That is, it allows the broadcaster to kind of say, yeah, I want to participate. Maybe I'll carry the message or not. Or if I'm going to carry the message, I'm going to wait for a commercial break. Instead, for this test, we wanted to see what does a live code do. If this actually literally simulates everything about a real emergency, including the type of coding that we're using, how well do the systems perform? And we found that for the emergency alert system, because it hasn't had as much attention recently as wireless emergency alerts, that's become a little antiquated.
And who would be responsible for making that change happen and looking at that?
Well, that conversation is significant at this point. The state of California, through the Office of Emergency Services, was asked by the county to essentially provide feedback on the county's use of the warning systems during our October fires. And as part of their report, they indicated that there were challenges in coordination at the local government level as well as with the state. And for the emergency alert system, we need to really develop that coordination in a much better form with the state of California.
And I kind of asked about this, but are there any requirements not to test the systems, but just to have the systems in a county? Are you supposed to have, you know, a wireless system in place like Code Red? Is that a requirement or is that just something that counties have decided to do? How does that work?
For the most part, public warning and alerting systems have kind of evolved over the years out of the civil defense days and have been traditionally used primarily for major catastrophic events that are kind of slow moving, if you would, like a flood event or a big winter storm that might be coming in. These no-notice dynamic events like wildfire are really demonstrating the fact that local governments have to not only make use of these systems, they're going to have to invest much more heavily in how they work with the community on getting those messages out. I'd also suggest that as local governments, most have picked up indirectly the alert and warning programs as an extension of their public safety mission. There is no mandate from the state of California. The local governments have to have a warning system.
Do you think things would have turned out differently in Butte County if they would have used WEA rather than Code Red?
I'm afraid I just don't know enough about that event to even begin to speculate.
What about for Sonoma County?
Oh, that's a challenging one because it makes an assumption here on use of these warning systems, first, that you know what's going on, that you have a complete picture, if not complete, a good picture of what the threat is and areas that are going to be threatened. And I'll share with you, I've been in the game 25 years. I've never seen a fire move like that. I live here in Santa Rosa and evacuated myself, and I've never seen such a dynamic, literally a beast roar out of the hills like that and move so quickly and span freeways and cause such an urban inferno. I'm not sure any program anywhere in the state would is prepared to deal with that kind of new hazard.
I was going to ask, you know, what you think still needs to be done in terms of emergency alerts, but it almost sounds like, I don't know, is there anything that can be done?
Absolutely. No, we're not hopeless in this. But basically, we have to really simply come to the understanding that alert and warning is no longer a sidebar or secondary function of local government public safety, that it needs to move to the forefront and be on par with public safety communications such as 911. We need to have several components in place. First, we need to have a good understanding of the hazards that may warrant the need and the use of the alert and warning system and which populations live in potentially impacted areas. And how are we going to communicate with them? Is it language issues, cultural barriers? Are there individuals with access and functional needs that we need to address in designing and developing these warning systems? A second major component is we need to have in place a process for quickly gaining a good picture of what's going on out there when we have a no-notice event unfolding. Can we not only give enough situational awareness to help facilitate and guide response by public safety people like fire and law enforcement, but can we get enough information to really help drive the alert and warning function as well? A third element, of course, is to make sure we have those technologies in place, that they perform as advertised, that they're well resourced and exercised and ready to go at a moment's notice. And finally, we have to work with our communities. We have to educate our residents and each other about what do these warning systems mean? What are their limitations? If warnings do go out, should we take action? If so, what kind of action should we take depending on the area we live in and the threat that we face? It really does take all four of those elements to make a comprehensive program effective for a large community and not just the technology.
That was Christopher Godley, Interim Emergency Services Manager of Sonoma County, talking with NSPR's Sarah Bohannon. And that's our program for Monday, December 10th, 2018, 32 days since the fire started. We are produced by Sarah Bohannon, Mark Albert, and Phil Wilkie. Adam Argusia composed our theme music. Special thanks today to Matt Fidler. Tomorrow, we hear from two fire researchers about some of the unique geographical elements that contributed to making the campfire so fast and so deadly. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.